Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Anna Hopkins, an actor you may recognize from Arrow, Shadowhunters, The Expanse, and a couple of episodes of Killjoys this season. She also co-stars with Aaron Abrams in Mark Slutsky's delightful short film Final Offer, and you'll see her opposite Kim Coates in the second season of Bad Blood, which premieres Thursday, October 11th on City TV. Oh, and she's also shepherding her own short film, The Give and Take, her first as a writer and director, around the festival circuit. Its next stop is at the First Glance Film Festival in Philadelphia on Friday, October 12th, and then it plays the Austin Film Festival October 25th and 29th. Anna picked E.T. the Extraterrestrial, Steven Spielberg's 1982 masterwork about a boy and his alien. Released a year after the breakneck adventure of Raiders of the Lost Ark, it marked a major change from the man who made his reputation on relentlessly paced films like Duel, Jaws, and 1941. But he'd hinted at this mode in the quieter moments of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and of course at the subject matter. Even so, E.T. is an almost shockingly tender work. A science fiction fantasy with a big, complicated climax, sure, but at heart it's a gentle fable about two lost souls making a connection that changes both their lives. Look, you don't need me to lay out the plot for this one. It's E.T. It's wonderful. This is someone else's movie.
Well, yeah, the question was, it was a really hard one. It was like, okay, what film are you going to choose? And I feel like there's just so many categories in your life when it comes to film. Like,
yeah.
And I think when you said formative at one point.
It's something that, yeah, it's one of the keywords I use to help people just focus on one title. You know, is it something... Because sometimes someone will pick something they've seen recently and fallen in before. And sometimes it's the movie that just hasn't left you.
Yeah. Right. I think that's kind of where it landed. As I mentioned to you earlier, we had three VHSs growing up. So I watched them all a lot.
And the other two, for the listeners, were previous episodes on the show. So
correct.
I had to disqualify.
Airplane and Labyrinth. So I ended up, you know, I would watch E.T. like every day. And it's totally stuck with me for the rest of my life, so.
So how old were you when you first saw it?
That's a good question. What year was it?
82.
Okay. I think, like, I can't remember, so it's the first time I had memories.
Right, it's always been there.
Yeah, it's always been there.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Isn't it?
Yeah. I was, what, I was still 13 in 82.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it on the first day at the Highland, which is no longer here, but it would have been it was a 70 millimeter theater. It would have been.
You saw it when you were 13?
Yeah.
That's so
I
fun.
Was basically, I think, I I'm the perfect 80s kid because I was roughly the same age as Elliot in E.T. when I saw E.T. And I was roughly the same age as Marty McFly when I saw Back to the Future.
Nice.
So it's just like, these movies were made for me! I know what it is!
Kind of.
Yeah.
Was definitely. Elliot 13?
He's not much older.
He looks so young.
Yeah. I'm sure we all did. But Henry Thomas, I think, was a little older than the character. He might have been 12 or 13.
Yeah.
But I could be wrong about this. How much younger is he supposed to be than Michael? Because Michael's a teenager.
Michael's like, yeah, I guess
he's
Michael's supposed to be like 16.
Mm-hmm. Riding his dirt bike. Gertie's 4.
Gertie, is she 4?
I think she's 3 or 4.
Barrymore was. She's so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
It is the kind of movie where you stop talking about the plot instantly and just fall into the feelings of it, right? And the things that you're connected to.
Absolutely.
I was trying to figure out how to get into the movie, like what is the angle, because it's not often, I think, that you realize you're watching a perfect movie while you're in it. Like, more often than not, it's later.
Yeah. Well, rewatching it, I mean, yes, it when it finished, it was like, yep, that is a perfect movie, 100%.
Mm-hmm.
But while I was watching it, the first thing that kept on happening was there were so many scenes that I completely forgot about. Because when you think about films that you watched when you were a kid, it's sort of like a mosaic of like five scenes that you just, they're like so visceral. Like when E.T. opens the beer.
Right.
Like, that whole sequence was just so fresh in my mind, you know? Mm-hmm. Or, especially the end, like, when they're in their hazmat suits and stuff, like, that was just so clear. But then there were other scenes, like, the opening scene, I forgot about. Like, I always imagined that the opening was the kitchen, the kitchen nighttime scene.
Okay.
Like, I just, that's sort of how you, you know, and then, so when I was sort of rewatching it, and it was like seeing it for the first time, like the landing, and that scene was kind of like a remind, well, actually, I never even noticed it as a kid, but God, it's a beautiful movie visually.
Yeah.
And you just don't, I mean, those are things that they resonate with you as a kid, but when you rewatch it, it's pretty incredibly beautiful.
Yeah. Well, you had said you hadn't seen it in a while, so how long had it been since this?
I would say since I was like 11 or 12.
And so this is you coming back to it for the first time?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, and you're a filmmaker yourself now, yeah. So you're, everything else, you're going to be thinking about lenses and colors and gels.
Oh, I was thinking about it all, and I was also thinking about how, like, you know, the short that I did, it was the first thing I kind of wrote, and I wanted to write something that would be accessible for me to try and shoot, and but I'm realizing all these ideas I had were just from this movie. Like, I'm like, ah, crap, you know, which is kind of nice, because it's nice realizing inspirations, you know, yeah, after the fact, but like, you know, not wanting to show the adults in my film. And then rewatching this, I'm like, oh, right. Of course. You know, it's like such a naive, but yeah.
Yeah. It's, but it's, I never caught it. I mean, I didn't occur to me, just because the subject matter is so different in your short. It would not, I would not have thought, oh, that's from E.T.
No.
So,
I guess it's interesting how things, little things sort of manifest. But it was a funny, I'm glad we're doing the film, because it is really sort of showing how much this film has influenced me and affected me. I mean, if we were going to be doing Airplane, it would just show up in the fact that, like, every day I reference Airplane and talk about Airplane jokes.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's shown up in much of my work yet.
That's it. That's the trick, right? You have to sneak. And as Esmer told me once, he managed to get the Amigo salute into an episode of Red Oaks, and it was his proudest moment as an actor.
That is good.
Yeah. I still haven't seen it. I haven't found it yet.
But, I mean,
if you could come up with a line in Killjoys or Shadowhunters where this is the wrong week for me to quit stabbing people or something.
I mean, I definitely use that GIF. I know there's a lot of people out there who,
we're going to get letters.
Yeah, so many letters. I think on one of the live tweets for Shadowhunters, and a very, very stressful one, I kept on, pick the wrong date, but it's like all teens, like really young teens, so they're just like, what is she doing?
Who is that old guy who kind of looks like Jeff Bridges?
Who's sniffing so much glue. I do, on set, when people are getting ready for a shot, I always kind of put in a Roger, Roger,
right.
Vector, Vector. And I just wait to hear for anybody who will say it back to me, and sometimes they do.
Oh, it's nice. It's a call and response.
Yeah.
It's a trust game.
Totally.
It's lovely. there aren't a lot of, I was trying to figure out, like, if there are lines you can repeat for yourself from E.T., like Cohen's, like that, but I was really struck the last time I saw it, because there's almost no dialogue in, like, half the picture.
No, it's a movie of feelings, I think, as you watch it.
And that coming after, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark has long action sequences with minimal dialogue, but this is so completely different.
I rewatched it with a friend of mine and her dad, and we all, after the sequence where it's the first reveal of E.T. To his brother and Gertie, and the way that sort of happens, there's like there's a couple of lines, but it's an astonishing sequence. It's so funny and so You know, there's a lot at stake, and it's beautifully done, and the choreography of it and blocking and everything is just incredible. And we all kind of, after the scene was over, just kind of was like, wow. I mean, that felt good to watch.
Yeah.
It's very satisfying.
It's one of those, I'm just going to keep coming back to the idea of how novel it is to see a movie that is all, like, there's a special effect in almost every scene. There's mm-hmm. something going on. There's crews and cables and puppets, and how physically complex it was to produce and shoot. And it doesn't feel for a second like the world is intruding on it. It captures a thing that, oh, I know how to get into this. Stranger Things, the show, does not understand what life was like in 1992. That's the amazing thing about it. It's a movie about that era, made by people who didn't grow up in it, didn't live in it, and for kids who can't understand it either. So nothing ever happens alone. There's always somebody else there. There's always chatter. There's always noise. Mm-hmm. Like, their version of that world is the Goonies, where everybody's yelling over each mm-hmm. other all the time. Mm-hmm. But what Spielberg gets right about 1982 and suburbia and like American life, the TV isn't always on, and sometimes you're just alone with yourself. Mm-hmm. And when, like, my parents split up when I was 10 mm-hmm. in 78, so I know exactly who that kid is.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, you don't know who you are. All you know is that your world doesn't make sense. Things are different. Nobody's talking about it. And no one will talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the fantastic intrudes into Elliot's life, it's just perfectly natural that he thinks he can control it. Like, he takes it over. And he's keeping
it. Yeah, this is his part, his life. Yeah. No, absolutely. I think there's something about the film and my experience watching it that's really similar. You know, our TV room in our house was like, it's so iconic in my mind. You know, it's in the basement. It was kind of redone, I think, like in the mid-70s. So it had like a mirror and then a lot of wood. There was a bathtub.
Okay. In the TV room?
Yeah. So funny. And there was a little door that you could crawl through and get to the other room. So it was kind of magical. And yeah, no, we weren't always watching TV. It was, when I think about that house, it was a lot of myself alone, with my imagination sort of rummaging around. And then sometimes I'd put on a movie and, you know, it offered me E.T. And, I was definitely the central character of my, you know, existence. And a lot of the time I was alone. I mean, there'd always be someone in the house somewhere. But I definitely, that feeling of sort of being a little bit of silence and a little bit of, especially as a kid, I think is really beautiful. And you're right, in that film, you really do feel it. And you don't get that in Stranger Things, or you don't get, I think Stranger Things is interesting because it's the interpretation of that era.
Yeah,
it's received. It's very nostalgic. Aesthetic. Yeah.
Yeah, and the idea of mashing up Stephen King and Spielberg and all that stuff. But it surprised me so much when it came out and people embraced it. And I realized the people embracing it aren't 40 and 50, they're 25.
Yeah.
They grew up on the movies.
Yeah.
So they're still seeing an adult's perspective on what a kid's life would have been then.
Absolutely.
And if you sit someone down in front of E.T., yeah, I always worried my nieces would think it would be boring, because it is. It's slow. It's not boring, but it is very deliberate in the first half. Except I keep forgetting there's also all this bicycle riding and chasing. And
so much.
There's motion. Stuff is always happening.
Yeah.
But it really does just stop down and sit and be with with Henry Thomas and this puppet, who isn't a puppet.
Well, that's the other thing. I'd never, ever thought about E.T. other than being E.T.
Right.
The alien.
Yeah, no, I totally get
until
that.
Until the last time I watched it, and I was like, wait, what? How did they, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
I never even thought about it, which is so weird.
Well, his pupils contract. Then why wouldn't they? He's real.
He's real.
I was at ILM for a thing, a press tour 6 or 7 years ago, and they have him.
Oh my God, I need to see that.
Yeah. I took some pictures. He's in a case. You can't touch him because people did. And they were touching him. Everybody said, I talked to the person in the room with him. There's a Yoda and an E.T. And an R2-D2. And you just,
oh my God.
You come in and I wasn't the only one. I saw this in everybody else's eyes. You well up a little bit and you go totally silent because you don't want to scare them. And it's just, it's everyone has the same response. And everybody was touching E.T. over his right eye. I don't know why, but that's where you're drawn. Maybe it's just the positioning of it or some kind of human primate instinct. But everyone was reaching out to touch the same spot, so they had to put a case over it because the latex was starting to fray. But it's just, it was so weird because even inanimate, he's alive.
Well, yeah, I mean, and we see him, you know, in those final scenes. I mean, I was crying a lot in this recent viewing.
I still cry.
When he's lying there. I mean, there's not a moment, especially as you know, like when you're in film, you often get taken out of things by, you know, knowing how they're done. And you think a lot about how did they do this scene. And that did not happen to me with this. Like, it's hard. Yeah. So he's, I'd like to now maybe start finding out how they did it and what went, you know, maybe have a look at some behind the scenes photographs and stuff.
Because well, there were little people in a suit. The head was remotely operated, basically like a drone would be now, like a car, a remote car, would be with handheld boxes, radio controlled, and also physical cables. There are a couple of shots of the set. Because that was the other thing that they did that was ingenious. They really protected the illusion in a way that almost no one did. At the time, I mean, there were all these... This was a couple of years after The Empire Strikes Back, and there were behind-the-scenes books, and there were elaborate galleries and photo spreads and Time magazine covers and all that. And with E.T., they always made sure that when the thing was photographed, it was photographed with a human being. They were making eye contact. There was activity. The cover shot of E.T. on, I think it was with Spielberg on Time magazine, and they shot one with Michael Jackson, which is still just incredibly creepy.
What? I need to see that.
He wrote a song. It was the thing. Okay. Neil Diamond wrote the song Heartlight, but they really didn't push it that hard. It's about E.T.
Oh my god,
little dead puppet man.
But yeah, I mean, that definitely informs, I think, all of our they never broke the fourth wall with that one,
and popular culture just embraced him
it
in a way that it happens now, but it's always, you know, brought to you by McDonald's. It's always really, really forced and artificial. And at the time, I mean, you know, Reese's Pieces had a deal with them and there was all this, but it felt, even though it was coming from the guy who made Jaws and Close Encounters and Raiders and was the single most successful filmmaker in history, I think at that point, it felt like a small little movie that everyone wanted to protect.
Well, that's how it feels. Like you're talking about, I mean, I guess at the age that I was watching it, I wouldn't have been just plugged in at all in terms of any promotional aspect to it. I knew nothing about it. I didn't even think I knew that Steven Spielberg directed it when I was a kid. Like, all this thing was a tape that we didn't even have the cover, and it just kept going into the VHS.
So it's like an artifact.
Totally. And my relationship to it was, it almost felt secret. Like, it was just this movie. And so, no, I would have never seen... You know, I guess we had CBC and CTV. Those were our two channels, and we wouldn't advertise necessarily on that.
No, I mean, if you were watching it...
I was watching it in 89.
Well, yeah, because it didn't come out on video until 88. It took forever. It was a big deal.
Oh, really?
That, yeah, they didn't release it for 6 years. Spielberg wanted it to be, and I'm sure Universal wanted it too, to be like a Disney thing that they brought back every 7 or 10 years to introduce to a new generation. And then they very quickly realized that if they released it on video for $30, they would make $30 billion.
They're like, okay, let's do that.
Yeah, so they rolled it out.
I guess we got like the first round.
Probably, yeah. And it was a huge deal at the time.
It's interesting to hear all this stuff because I know nothing about that.
Well, it's okay. There's not much to it, really. It's all just marketing.
You mean the
production stuff?
Well, no, but even the marketing stuff, like, you know, these nowadays, I feel like I know so much around a film, you know, something that you're waiting for, or you're excited for, or something that you loved or didn't love. Like, you know everything about how it was from the second casting starts, from the second someone's developing the script. And so I never really thought about E.T. and I always felt like it was this little film that I secretly watched by myself. But no, it was a huge thing.
It was, but you're right, too. It is something that is, like, it's so intimate and delicate and precious. It turns into, I mean, it's just dirt bikes, but it still turns into a full-on chase film. I had forgotten just how it elevates itself, how it escalates, but it comes back down to this story of a kid and an alien, and with almost no other stakes, right? Like, the whole point of their relationship is that the rest of the world goes away. It's almost, mm-hmm. I mean, it is a love story, but it's almost romantic.
You know, oh, yeah. Really, like, in the end, when they're saying goodbye, what does he say?
I'll be right here.
Yeah.
I know, it's incredibly powerful.
Yeah, it's really beautiful.
And the thing that I forgot between viewings, and I think it's been at least probably 5 or 10 years since I last, between my last viewing and my most recent viewing, and I forgot how not sophisticated, because it's, of course it is, it's Spielberg, he's going to make, yeah. Like, all the shots are at kid's eye level, yeah. And there's like the first time you see a car, it's the exhaust pipe, and just these beautiful choices of framing, and,
yeah.
and boxing off part of the screen to protect something, just subconsciously, and then going really big during the scene, during the beer scene where E.T. gets drunk and Elliot picks up on it, and like that's a massive, complicated, all the frogs running away.
Oh my god!
Incredibly busy.
Yeah, when the little girls sort of they kiss, right, and they're standing.
That's Erica Eleniak from, like, I think Baywatch, right? And she's in Under Siege. That was the first time I saw her in anything.
That's hilarious.
And yeah, it's just good casting, right? He knew he could get people to do this stuff.
Yeah,
but then it comes back. Then it collapses itself back down again, and opens up again when E.T. gets sick and Elliot goes looking for him, and the huge Halloween scene, and you never, right. Like, I every time I saw a big sequence like that, it's like, this is the same movie? I don't remember anything this massive. I just remember small things.
Yeah, like, that's
scenes
exactly.
Scenes in closets, scenes in kitchens, scenes in the outside, like
that
the dog
house. That was exactly my reaction to when I rewatched it. I had completely forgotten about the frogs.
Yeah.
And then also the Halloween sequence.
Yeah.
I completely forgot about it.
Yeah, they hide in there somehow. Mm-hmm. Just because, even though they're important to furthering the plot and moving story, they're not about Elliot and E.T. together, right? Yeah. Like, Elliot and E.T. are together at Halloween, but E.T.'s under a ghost costume, so they're not physically... It doesn't scan the same way.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there is a huge story going on, and the movie doesn't care.
No.
I guess. Like, it's really more about, like, Melissa Matheson's script just wants to focus on the relationships.
Yeah.
And this family that has this thing going on that they don't, like, Elliot clearly doesn't understand what's happening.
No. But he has, what I love about, what became so clear again, like, it's funny, when I watched it as a kid, it was very, his response to E.T. was very normal.
Sure.
Like, well, of course that's what you would do. But watching it as an adult, you realize how beautiful it is when the perspective of a child and a child's instincts when it comes to the things that matter.
Yeah.
Like, caring for somebody and protecting somebody that you love or loving somebody quickly. And it was, and Elliot, what's his name?
Henry Thomas.
I think I've watched his audition tape as many times as I've watched E.T. because as an actor, you know, you love watching stuff like that. But he was just, him as a person, you can tell, loved easily. And that's what Elliot was. And I think as a child, that's very natural. And so I think when kids watch it, I think they're connecting on that level. Whereas what's interesting with when it's an adult is you're saying, oh, wow, it should be like that, but
yeah,
it's not.
No, and you can think of a million reasons not to.
Absolutely.
And that's, weirdly, we don't... I was trying to figure out... It's obviously, it's conscious to keep the focus on the kids as much as possible, but Dee Wallace Stone gets so much time, so much more time than I remembered.
Right.
Because she's so present in their lives, and she's being shut out, and she plays that for the reality of it instead of, you know, a comedy mom role. Or like, you see her cry almost as soon as we meet her.
Yeah.
She's crying over the sink with the dishes, and it's just so much is going on, and it's necessary plot-wise to explain why she doesn't notice all this stuff, but it's also, as an adult, it's heartbreaking.
It's really heartbreaking.
To watch this woman alone with three kids and chaos that she doesn't understand and how her life is just completely derailed. And
absolutely.
Then that's even before the army shows up.
Right, until the very end. But, yeah, and I also loved, you know, the dynamic within the within the family that they're trying to protect her as well. You know, why did you bring up Mexico? Like opening. And it's just, it's a beautiful, she was great. I forgot about her too. I mean, I remembered one scene with her, and it was really that opening, but rewatching it. I mean, Elliot is like trying to protect her too. It's an interesting dynamic.
I've said this, it came up somewhere when we were talking about Close Encounters somewhere, that the amazing thing about that film is that there are no villains. Mm. There's just people who don't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And all these separate groups, including the military, that just, if they simply said what they knew, there would still be issues, but there wouldn't be adversarial relationships.
Right.
E.T. doesn't have a bad guy either. We think it does.
No.
But that's the amazing mislead, right? Because of the limited perspective, because we only know what E.T. or Elliot knows.
Yeah.
And so when Peter Coyote shows up, they call him Keys in the script. They never give him a name, this poor guy. Mm-hmm. And when his face is finally revealed, it's just like, oh, he's sad. He's got stuff.
Well, that's what was so interesting, too, is that I always remembered, you know, the government.
Right.
And the army and those doctors as being, you know, the villains and the antagonists. Mm. But now when you rewatch it, they're trying to help.
Yeah.
And it's in the wrong way. And it's still really heartbreaking. And when they're trying to revive, when they call the time that E.T. dies, something popped up for me that I hadn't noticed before was how, you know, sad they were and how defeated, truly defeated. And because a living thing was gone and a miracle, as he says, is gone. And it's like, just listen to the kid, guys.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah. But this is what I'm thinking, too. So much of modern cinema is based in, if not cynicism, then at least skepticism, mm-hmm. right? Like, of course they won't listen to a kid. He's a kid.
Yeah.
The movie never gets there.
No.
Like, E.T., the film, is still kind of willing at the very end to...
Yeah, because they, you know... It was interesting too that he's sort of roaming around during this time, and they're still going to him to, they're trying to ask him questions. They're involving him in this process, and you'd think, like, let's say they did revive E.T. at that moment, they'd be bringing Elliot with them, you know, and you can tell that's they're trying to sort of figure it out. But he has a lot of respect, absolutely.
Yeah. And it's true, we as the audience already know that Elliot is E.T.'s interpreter, mm-hmm. so of course he'd be invaluable.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, there's just that weird extra normal thing that's absolutely normal, where everybody is like, these are scientists. You're missing the one sentence at the beginning of, like, come on, guys, we ran the trials, we rehearsed this, we know what to do.
Yeah.
And they do, like, clearly do. Like, that. Yeah. The thing that I remember being stunned at this time through was when the scientist comes in and says he's got DNA and he's happy. Like, that's a revelation.
Yes.
It's a huge moment, and it blew right past me as a kid, because, like, me I too, don't care what that means. They're hurting him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Me too.
But it's like, of course, this is this is the culmination of human history to this point.
Absolutely.
They're freaking out.
Yeah, they've been waiting for this forever.
Yeah.
And that's why it's also, it's watching them fail.
No, you feel for them.
Absolutely.
Like, everybody in this movie is trying to do
their best.
Yeah, and maybe probably the right thing.
Yeah.
Maybe not everybody, but, I mean, there isn't even a bully. It's not like,
no.
It's not that kind of movie.
No.
And it still manages to be, like, heart in mouth thrilling in that last third. Well, this is what I was saying before. The last time I stumbled across it on cable was the scene where the spacesuits invade.
Mm.
Like, that moment where the lights come right up and there's a terrifying spaceman at the door. And I
Oh my God.
Yeah, I mean, I remember...
With the big helmet?
Yeah, in the theater. It was terrifying, but I didn't remember it as being an E.T. just that image. Mm. And I'm usually really good at identifying something from a couple of frames. So and I know E.T. inside and out, but I came across and I was like, what is this? And it took at least 30 seconds for me to figure it out. And it's because its tone is so completely different.
Yeah.
It's, you know, there are a couple of jump scares, but they're sort of lighthearted and mm-hmm. funny, the mm-hmm. flashlight in E.T.'s face and all that. But this is like, this is where you're reminded, oh yeah, this is the guy who made Jaws. He knows, he knows how to terrify you. He knows
how to do that, yeah. Oh yeah.
And it's also the signal that the film is moving into something else, something that, like, the larger half or the larger third of the story is kicking in now, where the family is quarantined and the army is involved. And, like, the world is suddenly much, much larger.
Much, much larger. And, yeah, I mean, from, as you said earlier, it's like, what's going on in the other version of this movie is, you know, a beautiful scientific development that, you know, everyone's been waiting for. But from Elliot's perspective, it's fucking terrifying, excuse my language. And his friend is being taken away from him, and it's that shift in tone, totally. Because they're in the bedroom. They're right before that guy shows up. They're in the bedroom, right?
With the mom. Yeah, because Elliot's been missing, and they've both gone missing, and they come home.
And so he shows up.
He's been, yeah.
They close the fridge door and he's standing there.
Yeah, and she has that amazing moment where she spins on a dime in the middle of a sentence. You know, like, she's furious with him and then realizes he's...
He's, I loved that.
And just turns it back to, don't ever do this again. And she just, I don't think she even finishes the sentence. No. She's just sort of cuffing it out.
Yeah.
And I remember this time, like, I remember it differently. It's just like, oh, of course, that's what a human being does.
Me
too. She loves him. That's what that is.
Yeah.
And...
That stuck out for me as well.
Yeah. Yeah, she's amazing. And then the rest of it is played as someone, like her, she's playing someone who is struggling to process, mm-hmm. right? Because not only has all of this stuff happened, but she's surrounded by the military.
She's like, what is, totally and also, unprepared. You know, yeah, and trying to, it's interesting in that, in those sequences, you can see she doesn't understand necessarily what's going on, but she understands that this is supremely important for Elliot. Mm-hmm. And so there's that sort of, she's protecting him. She's not taking their side. You know, she's really kind of trying to figure out what's going on for him. And also, he was ill.
Yeah.
But even when he gets better, she's trying to process why this is, what's going on for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, she's completely in the moment even more than the kids are. She's just making decisions on the fly and stumbling through it. And yeah, it's one of those movies where I think, you know, Spielberg's he's talked about the ending of Close Encounters not sitting right with him now because there's no way Roy would leave his family. But when you're younger, that's the movie you make because it's about the adventure and you don't really understand what having a family is. This is just 5 years later and he's already...
It's so sophisticated.
Fully aware of that bond, yeah.
Well, yeah, because the way that Elliot and E.T. are written, as their relationship is... That's somebody who profoundly understands love and family and the importance of those feelings, for sure.
Yeah. It's just such a... I mean, I know why Gandhi won Best Picture that year and why he didn't win the Oscar until Schindler's List, but it really is. Like, it's one of the... It's just... It's such a unique and special film. It sounds like it sounds dumb to even have to say it out loud, but it's in danger of disappearing.
Absolutely. I'm just so happy that I got to rewatch it for this because it can kind of just live in your past and, you know, you just say what you need to say about it. It's one of the best films ever. You know, it's unique. We gotta see it on a big screen somewhere in town or something. I mean, especially for kids.
I'm trying to think if we've ever screened it for the Now Free Flicks program. I don't know that we ever did. Maybe we should. We will. Maybe we can do that over Christmas or something. But yeah, it would be great. And the re-release in 2002, the 20th anniversary that they did, was, you know, a well-meaning abomination. They took the guns out and did you ever see that?
No.
Yeah, it's on that, it's on this 2-disc DVD set.
What did they do? The reason
I still have it. So they recut it slightly to make it suitable for contemporary audiences. And so what they did was, there's a couple of small edits to the soundtrack. Elliot doesn't say penis breath anymore.
That's my favorite line. fine.
And it's a terrible insult. It's so perfect for a kid.
I mean, that was one of the other things that I like remained so clear in my head was that insult. And yeah. how could they take that out?
Yeah, well, they took that out, and then this is the more infamous thing. Digitally, they replaced the guns with walkie-talkies. So there's only one shot. It's the trigger for the flying sequence during the chase.
Okay.
Elliot sees the guns. It sees two FBI guys come out of a sedan, blocking them at the bottom of the hill.
Yeah.
And the kids are all on their dirt bikes coming at them. And there's a snap zoom. It's frames are dropped to make it more immediate. And Elliot registers the shotgun.
Right.
And his terror is what triggers E.T. to save them.
Right.
But it was gone. It was just like they're holding walkie-talkies, and it's an incredibly awkward digital fix that doesn't make it into any subsequent restoration or the Blu-ray or the 4K discs.
I hope not.
No, they went back to the originals.
I mean, what's wrong with seeing fear from guns that are not being shot?
Well, I think it was right after 9/11 and everybody was just nervous about everything.
Yeah.
And it's, again, you know, those retrospective choices. Oh, well, if I was making the movie now, I wouldn't have done that. So, well, you didn't, though. You made it then, and that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's also got to be legitimately terrifying.
Absolutely.
He has to be afraid of them.
I mean, also, as you say, it's what makes E.T. make a bicycle fly.
Yeah.
We need something.
Yeah.
And it is great. Talkies.
Even though we've already seen them do it, it's still, it's so thrilling. And again, you know, I don't think we've mentioned John Williams yet, but his score is just so important to that. And again, I always say this about his stuff. You don't need the dialogue for most. I've ended up accidentally watching Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom twice without any sound.
Really?
And just fascinated by it. And like twice, once it was here at home and once it was at a bar, it was playing. Mm-hmm. And I just ended up watching the whole movie. And it's cut to action so well. Mm. It's so clear what everything is. Even in the dialogue scenes, you can see what's at stake. And you don't need the dialogue, but it does lack the music. Right. And I realized later that the reason it didn't bother me was because I was playing the score in my head.
In your head, yeah. You know it so well.
Yeah. And E.T. is almost better proof of that because there is no dialogue in so much of the film.
Yeah.
It's just small woodwinds and low tones and then huge explosive symphony, and it is such an intrinsic marriage of intrinsic's probably the wrong word, but it so beautifully weds image to sound.
Yeah.
And that score is, again, you hear it on like my endless listen to classical radio, and it shows up all the time.
Absolutely, yeah. I actually listened to part of it after, because, again, it becomes part of your experience as a child, but when you're kind of trying to piece together how someone makes something that incredible, you start to block off, okay, well, what's this and what's that? And absolutely, the score, I heard it in a very different way. And then, listening to it after, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it really is. Even this chase music, which is way faster and more rousing, a lot of urgency, it's still symphonic. It's a suite.
Absolutely. Right?
Like, it's just beautiful to listen to.
Yeah.
And this is where I betray my utter lack of musical terminology. It just sounds good.
I think it sounds great.
It sounds real nice. But it does, and it makes the puppet live. It does a lot of feeling for E.T. when he's just in silhouette.
Absolutely.
You sense hesitation and
fear
and terror, and it's just, oh, damn it. Yeah, no, it's just so
I'm trying
weird.
To think of the what was going on. I loved that beer sequence and then the cutting back and forth. And there, I don't remember exactly what it sounded like, but there was something pretty...
It's kind of frantic.
Yeah.
Really chaotic.
It was a fun, weird sequence.
Yeah. It's like the basket chase in... or the market chase in Raiders, where things just sort of hop along here and there on woodwinds and brass. Mm-hmm. I think that's what they're using. I'm probably dead wrong. It's so
we should look that up later.
But yeah, it's just... Everything about it is like the best possible version of what it could have been. Mm-hmm. And feels like a miracle, and we're like 36 years down the road and the 4K disc came out and it didn't sell
really
terribly well, and I'm just
36 years
we're old. I'm old. it's been long enough that almost everything about movie going has changed to the point where I bet you could get an audience of 10-year-olds to just sit in total silence for it,
Absolutely.
But no one thinks they will. So everything else is bright colors and busy activity. And mm-hmm. I mean, the first hour of this film is so calm and thoughtful.
Yeah.
In a way that children's films aren't supposed to be. And you know, really, it's not a film for children. It's a film for anybody who remembers what it was like to be a child.
Yeah.
And
also kids. Yeah. It's such a good example of how much more sophisticated children, or the sophistication of film that children appreciate, and the way that we process the, you know, information as kids. It's really valuable to have films like this. I piece together a lot of how I see the world because of E.T. And I watched that when I was 6 years old, you know, and kids just, I mean, I think there's a lot of sophisticated film for kids too. Like, a lot of Pixar stuff is definitely, in a very different way.
Yeah.
Very sophisticated when it comes to emotions and sort of like exploring that stuff. But it's nice to have a film for adults that kids watch.
Yeah.
It helps.
Yeah, it does. We'll just
figure things out.
Yeah. And it is a sort of a primer for adulthood, for responsibility and for maturity.
Absolutely.
And empathy, just understanding other
empathy
people.
Empathy is a huge one in there. Our first DVD, which I discovered one Saturday morning and later told my dad that I watched and he freaked out, was Blue Velvet.
Okay, sure.
That's not an adult film that kids should definitely watch.
Probably not.
Although,
if it was on DVD, it must have been like the late 90s, early 2000s, right? You were.
Yeah, it probably was like a teen. Enough. Yeah. I remember still, being though. Pretty young, yeah.
That is.
But still appreciated it, yes, as a young person.
I was going to say, that is going to give you some weird ideas about what grown-ups do.
So, yeah.
I mean, I was 22, and that was, or 20, and that was definitely my response.
Yeah.
I wasn't even 20. No, shit, I was 18. It's like,
yeah, you're like, wait, is this what happens?
That better not be sex. I have some questions.
I don't want that.
And now this episode has taken a turn.
Yeah, anywho.
I was worried I would reveal too much about myself in this episode. But mostly about my own love for the little E.T. man.
Yes.
But yeah, it's, oh God, no, it's such a wonderful film.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of touched on it, but is there anything beyond the low angles and the absence of adults in The Give and the Take, is there anything else necessarily that you've taken from the film?
I think one of the biggest things I realized was that I really liked, as we mentioned earlier, seeing what a kid would do in a certain situation,
mm-hmm.
as normal to them or natural to them. And I think with my short, it was kind of like, okay, well, what would this kid do if she found an old magazine? You know, would she dial the number or would she know that the number wouldn't exist anymore? And she'd probably dial it. And then, you know, she'd chat with somebody for a while. And, you know, I just wanted to sort of see what a kid would do naturally without asking all the questions and analyzing things that we all do, you know, every second of the day.
Right.
And I noticed that the way that Elliot sort of navigated through this was something that I really appreciated. Sort of simple, guided by, you know, your instincts and just going for it.
Yeah.
So I kind of noticed that.
Kind of a guilelessness, like an openness to whatever's
really
happening.
Really open and, like a lot of feeling, but not overthinking stuff, which I loved. You know, it was so clear with Elliot as you watch, like he's following his instincts. And they're beautiful instincts because he's a child and it's amazing.
Yeah, it is kind of wonderful.
Yeah.
It's just the kind of, you know, someone could make one. It just don't make this movie. You know, we have Mac and Me for that, for mm-hmm. an example of why you shouldn't do a film
right.
like this. But I want to believe that the world can still produce a film like this that is as specific and small, even when it's being huge and
mm-hmm.
literally like changing the future of humanity and all of that other
yeah.
stuff. I don't know where it is. I hope that someone, you know, finds the videotape and watches it and gets inspired to do that, but in their own way,
mm-hmm.
in a way that's different And then I hope that we recognize it when it happens, because I don't know that we would.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. One film I found had a similar, in a completely different way, but a similar sort of approach with a child following their instincts in what is otherwise like a pretty insane context is Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Oh, yeah.
And that sort of... There's an innocence, but there's a sophistication to children when they are making their decisions and following their instincts. And it's almost like, you should listen to the kid, or you should follow that kid. There's a sophistication in not overthinking stuff. And there was a bit of a similar essence I found, although a completely different film, obviously.
Yeah, it's not a comparison I would have thought to make, but there are definitely echoes in mm-hmm. the confidence and in the way that the movie handles.
Mm-hmm. And not questioning things that are otherwise, you know, a little too far in the imagination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, when you're a kid, you don't know that things aren't supposed to be a certain way, right? Like, you just respond to whatever's put in front of you. And, yeah, that's a good point of comparison. The other one I was thinking of was Vincent Ward's movie The Navigator, which was in the late 80s.
I didn't see that.
And it's a New Zealand film about a group of... I don't even know how to describe it. A group of villagers in the plague years, during the Black Plague, who go looking for a cure and end up somehow kind of popping out in the present day and following a little girl who is their leader. It's a little boy in The Navigator. It's a little girl in Vigil, his previous film. And it's, they're again, nothing at all like E.T., but they're sort of about kids seeing through a situation, and adults just understanding that they have to trust them, which is also kind of not the point of E.T. It's like, it's not Mom's journey, it's Elliot's, but it is, it's an echo. It's a thing that I think maybe made those films possible.
Yeah, because it's a fun journey to head over with the kid through something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And especially because that's not how we would do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, we would definitely make those early phone calls and then there'd be no film. But to follow a child through their... I mean, I guess Guillermo del Toro does that a lot,
Pan's
too.
Labyrinth just sort of flashed through my head, too, while we were talking.
Yeah. Which it takes you places that we don't go.
Yeah.
And all it takes is following what we think a child's instincts would be. Mm-hmm. It's not even, it doesn't require much else.
Yeah. And look where you go.
Yeah. Exactly.
My thanks to Anna Hopkins, who you can see in the second season of Bad Blood when it returns Thursday, October 11th on City TV. You should also watch her torment Aaron Abrams in Mark Slutsky's short film Final Offer, which you can find on Vimeo.com under the staff picks. It's pretty cool. And keep an eye out for Anna's short film, The Give and Take, at a festival near you. If you're in Philadelphia, it's screening at the First Glance Film Festival Friday, October 12th. And if you're in Austin, you can catch it at the Austin Film Festival, October 25th and 29th. You can find Anna on Twitter at AnnaBananaHops, all one word. And you can find E.T. the Extraterrestrial on 4K, Blu-ray, and DVD from Universal Studios Home Entertainment. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever you enjoy the show, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps. It truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.
All of those, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.